to celebrate International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. We will celebrate children from around the world and honor the diverse cultures that exist and thrive in the Portland area. The International Children's Day festivities will offer a rich intercultural program that will include singing, acting, puppet shows, arts and crafts, and ethnic food. Again, that's International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 on Facebook or at grendelscoffee.com.
Thanks for listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Julia Cook is a Portland native reporter who now divides her home between Cuba, Mexico, and New York. She reports from Cuba and Mexico and teaches writing in New York. She's the author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. This book examines Cuban life for the new generation and a new era. After more than 50 years of Fidel Castro's era, he handed the country to his brother, Raul. Raul Castro has been regarded as a more progressive leader, and the younger generation has been resourceful in accomplishing their own goals amidst a communist regime. Still, there is so much unknown about Cuba due to the lack of access to this nation. While Julia Cook was visiting her native Portland back in April, we met up at the Selwood branch of the Multnomah County Public Library for a chat about her book. Julia Cook and I discussed the assumptions and realities of this nation experiencing rapid change. We began our discussion with the historical context of communist leaders in Latin America and how this impacted Cuba's history. I think what most people know and think of when they think of Cuba is kind of the old revolution, it's called the Barbudos, referring to like Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. That's what people know, but really there's so little we do know, given the history and the lack of access to this country. But I guess some context towards how you got the inspiration and the motivation for your book.
It comes from exactly what you just said. Our cultural references when it comes to Cuba here in the States are all so outdated. They're, you know, a man who is 80-something years old at this point, a man who was dead 50 years ago, old cars that were made 60, 70 years ago. If we throw in the USSR, an entity that hasn't existed for 20 years, these are our references as Americans with Cuba. And so what I found when I studied abroad there as a college student in 2004 was a completely different Cuba. And so the reason why I wanted to write this book was because I was frustrated. I felt that the Cuba that I had seen was so much more vibrant than that, you know, filled with people headbanging to the Red Hot Chili Peppers of all groups to headbang to. And, you know, a lot of vibrancy, people making ends meet in unique and different ways. Young people being young people, just like they are everywhere else, and not really listening to the Buena Vista Social Club or going to very many baseball games or smoking cigars. So that was what I really wanted to move toward with this book.
Do you think that what you experienced had more to do with just the times have changed or to do with Fidel Castro handing the reins down to his brother Raul Castro? Or what do you think those changes, what do you think the changes are attributed to?
I think it's all of the above. I think at the beginning, I started going to Cuba in 2004. So that was before Raul Castro took the reins in 2008. He took the reins provisionally a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. but he took the presidency in 2008. And he has made changes, sure, definitely. But what I was observing had started to be in place as of 2004. And I think a lot of it had to do with me hanging out with a much younger crowd. Young Cubans are much more savvy and sophisticated than Americans would think they are. So again, part of it is the times changing. Part of it is me hanging out with younger people. And part of it is definitely the fact that I was woefully ignorant, just like we all were. And so it was that much more shocking and exciting to me.
Since you experienced Cuba under both, under Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, what are the most glaring differences that you noticed in your travels?
So Cuban communism kind of began to erode as of the early 1990s, when the USSR fell. That was when Fidel began to try to attract tourism to the country to save the economy. The economy had lost; they'd lost a third of their GDP with the Soviets, and they were horrifically poor at that point. So they really tried to invest in a tourism infrastructure and get tourists to come in. That, in its own way, introduced a host of problems. Sexual tourism became a thing again, and that hadn't been a thing since before the revolution, primarily because of Cuba's independence from the global capitalist marketplace. So there was that. Cubans weren't allowed to go into hotels. There began a system of tourist apartheid, which was pretty awful. Made Cubans feel like second-class citizens. And that was emphasized. I mean, I've left the most important thing for last, a dual economy. Mm-hmm. There's the Cuban peso and then the dollar, which was in use then. So those changes were in place and starting as of the early 90s, mid-90s. So when I talk about things changing under Raul, it feels much more like a movement toward. Those changes began in the 90s, and Fidel was implementing them bit by bit since then. So the movement toward a more flexible version of their socialism or communism began in the 90s. It's just that it's sped up a little bit in the last 4 years.
Okay. Talk about the special period, what that meant in the context of Cuba's history.
It was really shocking in the context of Cuba's history. It was a time of horrible privations and awful poverty and a lot of death because people tried to leave the country on rafts, and a lot of those rafts just fell apart. So it was a real shock to Cuba's system. Cuba had been held aloft by the USSR and that privileged relationship that they had economically with the USSR. And all of a sudden that disappeared. And so it was this very quick turnaround into a nosedive into poverty. And the government didn't really know what to do. Neither did the people. There was not enough gas for cars or buses, so people rode their bikes. And to this day, bikes are seen very poorly in Cuba because they're a really painful reminder of the poverty of the special period. Its mark can still be seen today.
Which led to a lot of rations and inequality to some extent. Throughout our discussion, Julia Cook talked about the contradictions of communism and its notion of equality. Historically, for example, women comprised about half of the medical professional workforce. Additionally, LGBT rights have also come a long way in Cuba.
This is where we start going in circles, right? Yeah. Because talking about Cuba is just so difficult because, you know, in order to talk about LGBT rights in Cuba, you can't leave out the fact that it was illegal to be gay at the beginning of the revolution, and people were put into work camps forcibly. So things being, a little more accepted today is a pretty drastic turnaround from a time when to be gay in Cuba was a horrible cross to bear. Mm-hmm. It was painful. And yet, before the special period, what you said about women, women were a lot more equal with men in terms of the workforce. Women, there were fewer, the ration card was a lot more comprehensive. People had more food. So it was an oddly homogenous, at least in my interviews and my readings have led me to believe that it was more of an oddly homogenous society that a lot of people still chose to leave because it was still ruled by a single party. And if you were gay or if you were anything that was not convenient to the regime, very religious or super hippie, you were not welcome. And this is the problem with insists on this homogeneity.
Right.
And that is just, I mean, there are a host of issues with capitalism, don't get me started. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I found that emerged as the persistent, awful thing about Cuban communism especially was the way that it insists on homogeneity. And that's not human.
Additionally, other communities have faced severe repercussions for not, quote unquote, contributing to the new regime. This includes people with disabilities and racial minorities. Julia Cook commented on this as well.
Well, and this is, again, like, Cuba is just such a land of contradictions. Mm-hmm. Like, disabilities are, I know a filmmaker who has a child with Down syndrome, and he will talk freely and wonderfully about how amazing it is to live in a country where he knows that his child will be cared for. That's not something that he has to bear on his own. The community helps him, and that's wonderful. That's incredible. As far as racial inequality is really persistent in Cuba. It's really persistent. There was a study done, a book published in 2007 by a Cuban economist called something along the lines of The Racial Problem in Cuba. And it's quoted in the book, but it found that 85% of jails are filled with darker skinned Cubans. I found it so wonderful. I think it's so heartening that Raul Castro's regime published this book by this lauded economist in Cuba about the racial issues that really laid out statistically and incontrovertibly the trouble. So that signals an opening that I find very heartening in that regard.
That's interesting. It's like... a government is admitting to its own flaws, you know, and I think that's just not something we experience very often.
Yeah.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta in conversation with Julia Cook. She is a Portland native reporter and author of the book, The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. We spent the first part of our interview discussing Cuba's history and its impact on the present. In this second half, we talk more about the characters in her book and her personal experiences. In a sense, Raul Castro is seen as, quote unquote, a more progressive leader for Cuba in this new era. So I'm curious, how does the older generation feel about this? Because the younger generation, or the people that you are hanging out with, you know, have goals and they're working towards them that the older generation would not have had the same opportunities. So how do the two, or if several generations, how are they experiencing this?
They're experiencing it in very different ways. These changes are, again, the land of contradictions. This is the thing. Nothing is simple when it comes to Cuba, ever. It's just impossible to get your head around sometimes. So the young generation today has a lot more economic opportunity in terms of the ability to open a restaurant, for example, or a bar, or anything that's not professional. Professionals are still not allowed to practice anywhere other than for the state. So that is a certain freedom. What the older generation has that they don't was the older generation, like Elaine, the woman that the family that I lived with in Cuba, she came from this generation of Cubans who got master's degrees because they could. They came of age in pre-special period Cuba, and so they were a little bit less economically motivated. This generation that I was spending my time with, they were raised in this period of horrible poverty. So it's totally understandable to me that they are very focused on figuring out how to make money. Elaine's generation was a little different because it was for the most part a little better off, which is not to say that people didn't leave then too. Like plenty of people left, plenty of people had tremendous issues with lots of aspects of the regime. But she in particular was someone who helped me really understand the difference in the motivation between the generations. So I think people her age and older, there is on the one hand optimism about these new reforms, and on the other hand a lot of hesitance and frustration, because it's like, imagine being told by someone that now you should be able to do it on your own when you've never been asked to do it on your own before, and you're not, you don't feel that you've been given the tools to do it on your own, whatever it is, as abstract as that is. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of Cubans are, certain Cubans who have the more entrepreneurial spirit are excited about these reforms. And some of them are just like, what? Where is this coming from?
I mean, to be fair, everybody has their contradictions. That would be very hypocritical to say that we are not a land of contradictions and we have our own issues.
Well, and I got a really interesting, I read at Powell's last night, and I got a really interesting question afterwards from this guy who was talking about how he went to Cuba once and he had such a hard time wrapping his head around the healthcare system and the education and the poverty and the cracking down on dissent. And he was like, how can those things all coexist? It's hard for my brain. And it made me think a lot about the fact that that kind of response says so much about our country and where we're coming from. Because I think it's hard for some of us here to wrap our heads around coming from a country that's so wealthy and where we have so many amazing freedoms and we don't provide the healthcare and the education. And so I think that's something that when you look at Cuba, I think that's where a lot of Americans get kind of twisted around about what Cuba could be like for Cubans, because it's where we're coming from. That's defining what we're seeing a little bit.
For them, it's just, it's life. It's every day, and you don't have to think so hard about it.
Well, in the same way that these contradictions in the U.S. are just ours. And we fight against them in many instances, or we support them in other instances.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some of your personal experiences there, such as what was your most interesting experience and your most challenging, and they might be the same.
I have, and it comes across in the book, I'm sure. I really love Cuban collective taxis. I really love maquinas. I think it's such a brilliant solution to the issue of transportation. I love collective taxis on an aesthetic level and also on a practical level. Like, I love the fact of them. I think it's a really awesome solution to the issue of transportation. It's basically like car sharing. And I think it's also really fun. I had a great time talking to random people and learning random things in them. So I think I would have to say that maquinas are my most interesting experience. And I think as far as most challenging, there were moments when I found it really hard to maintain my distance from certain subjects. And, you know, I think that happens anytime any writer or journalist is in a position of privilege over his or her subjects. I know that Catherine Booz talked a lot about it, and Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, both women writers that I really tremendously admire. And I felt that weight too. You're not sure how to observe compassionately or responsibly in many instances. Right. So,
actually, that brought up another tale. I was really fascinated by Sandra, the jinetera. Just her life. I assume that's one of the people you're referring to in this situation. So I guess if you don't mind talking a little bit about that.
Yeah, Sandra was a young sex worker. It was hard for me especially to look at men in Cuba the same way, foreign men. After hanging out with her and spending time with her, I found myself becoming very, very angry. And it became difficult in certain ways to socialize. even totally on my own. But she's a contradiction in every way. She's mm-hmm. she's incredibly savvy. She's smart and funny and uneducated and pregnant. And it was, you know, in many instances she would act very irresponsibly, and she was always trying to hustle me. And so to learn how to be that ambivalent about someone, to really, I thought she was really cool and funny and interesting, and I liked spending time with her when things were going right. And then at the same time, I was also on my guard constantly with her, and trying to keep my distance in certain ways.
Yeah, I imagine that was a challenge for your work and for your self. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Well, what do you want listeners and readers to take away from your story?
Just that Cuba is weird and awesome in many ways. And I would hope that listeners would be interested to read the book, and to come to it with as few preconceived notions as possible. And I would hope that they would learn something.
Definitely. And what do you hope for the new Cuba?
I would hope that the new Cuba would be able to, that Cubans would be able to experience increased freedoms on the island without Cuba losing its, what I consider to be its essence, which is a slower pace of life, more emphasis on interpersonal relationships and spending time with people, the distinct lack of really aggressive globalization in the form of like these massive corporations, and if there was a way for them to figure out how to both allow personal freedoms and economic freedoms without entirely doing away with what they have achieved, that would be heaven.
Great. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me for KBOO Community Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Julia Cook, author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. Julia Cook grew up in Portland and now reports from Mexico and Cuba and teaches writing in New York. To learn more, check out her website at julia-cook.com. That's COOKE. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for listening.
take a little time out. Do you? Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
Native American Business Network is holding its 12th annual Trading at the River Conference and Native Marketplace at Lewis and Clark College, May 27th through the 29th. ONABEN is a nonprofit public benefit corporation created by Northwest Tribes to increase the success of private businesses owned by Native Americans. Trading at the River features inspirational speakers, informative panels, and valuable workshops for small business owners and economic development organizations. ONABEN also welcomes community members to come check out the Native Marketplace, a highlight of the event, which features over 20 Native vendors. It is open to the public from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., May 29th at Lewis and Clark College at Smith Hall. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found on kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
National Tap Dance Day is May 24th, and KBOO is proud to co-sponsor a celebration of tap dance. Tap workshops will be held from 12:15 to 5:15 at the Grand Finale Dance Studio at 875 Portland Avenue in Gladstone, Oregon. And at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, there will be performances including Yearly Sunset, Shoehorn, Aaron Wheeler K, and Skylark Tappers. Again, that's May 24th at the Grand Finale Dance Studio and the Clinton Street Theater. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Sun Ra. Hailed as one of the great big band leaders, pianists, and surrealists of jazz in the New York Times. Composer, keyboardist, bandleader, philosopher, poet, and self-proclaimed extraterrestrial. Sun Ra arrived on the Earth 100 years ago on May 22nd, 1914. This Thursday, May 22nd, 2014, KBOO will dedicate the airwaves to 12 hours of the music, life, and philosophy of one of the 20th century's greatest avant-garde artists, Sun Ra. Beginning at 7 p.m., continuing all night long until 7 a.m. with a special in-studio performance of the Sonic Innovators Orchestra, featuring students of Thera Memories and conducted by David Ornette Cherry at 9 p.m. That's this Thursday, beginning at 7 p.m., a 12-hour tribute to the phenomenon known as Sun Ra, here on KBOO Portland.
How do you stop it?
Alrighty, you are listening to KBOO Portland, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Hello and welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm SW Conser. Today we'll be talking about empowering creative youth to make films. Lauren Grant and Lizzie Freeman will be in the studio from Free Arts Northwest.
And we'll be hearing about an animation festival from the Netherlands that's making its first tour of the West Coast.
But first, let's welcome back to the studio Hannah Piper Burns and Ben Pop of the Experimental Film Festival. Hannah and Ben, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us again.
Yeah, so this is, which incarnation of the Experimental Film Festival is this?
Three.
Number three? I remember last year it was quite a scene. It was at Studio 2 in Southeast Portland, sort of the Southeast industrial area, and it had a great village kind of community feeling. You're going to be at different venues this year, but you're trying to maintain that whole feeling of community with lots of food and drink and mingling and things like that.
Well, not as much food.